It's a joy and a privilege to be able to be speaking to you tonight about the topic of the three uses of the law. And if we take a step back and let's say we go all the way back to the beginning, we can say that in the Garden of Eden, we as human beings had a difficulty, to say the least, in obeying the law of God. God commanded Adam and Eve, don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day that you eat of it, you'll surely die. And of course, we know all too well that they broke the covenant. We also know that God gave his law to Israel there at Mount Sinai, and we know that they had a problem with obeying God. I can remember it was years ago where my toddler son was sitting in the back seat of the minivan as we were driving down the road, and my son was looking at his children's Bible, and as he was in the way back and I was in the way front, he was turning the pages, and he said, "Dad, how come Israel was always disobedient?" I said, "Yes, son, that is the question, isn't it? That is the key question." I mean, so this is something that even a small child of 3 years old could detect just from reading his children's Bible. Well, we can fast forward into our own day and to the culture in which we now live, and we know that we are a culture that would say that the word obedience or law would be likened perhaps unto a curse word, because it means that we have to surrender our power. We have to surrender our autonomy. We have to obey someone else. We can say that our culture, we are filled with the children of Nietzsche, and it was Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher of the 19th and early 20th century, who said, we have to will to power. In other words, we get to decide what is good and what is evil. We are the ones who determine morality. And though these words from Judges chapter 17, verse 6 were written about Israel long ago, we can say this about our world and about our culture, that every man does what is right in his own eyes. Every man does what is right in his own eyes, because at least in Israel's day, for there was no king in Israel. And the assumption of many people out there in the broader culture is there is no king. There is no God. I am God, and I get to decide how to live. And so sadly, not only in the wider culture, but perhaps sometimes even in the wider church, a lot of Christians have a dim view of the law. Like Dr. Van Drunen said in the previous lecture, there are a lot of people out there, they look at the law as if it is something arbitrary that God hammered out. Again, going back to my small toddler son, he blurted out to me one morning when I told him he couldn't do something, "Dad, you're ruining my life." I thought, you know, I knew I would hear these words one of these days. I just didn't think when it would be when you were three. I thought I at least had 10 more years. Till you get into, forget the terrible twos, the terrible teens, right? You know, we've all kind of been there in one way or another. You know, but if this is the attitude that we have towards the law, then we're going to really have a lot of trouble in the Christian life, a lot of trouble in the Christian life. And how much does that particular attitude, one that we think, oh, God's out to ruin our lives because he's made up these arbitrary rules that keep me from doing the things that I want to do, how different and how diametrically opposed is that attitude to the attitude of the psalmist when he says in Psalm 119, verse 97, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day." Oh, how I love your law. Is that the attitude that we have about God's law? Well, maybe it's not. And it certainly should be if that's the attitude of the psalmist. But it's helpful for us to understand how the law functions so that we can have a right understanding of it and therefore ultimately a right relationship to it, so that we can not only properly esteem it and love it, but so that we can also rightly use it. That, I think, is crucial. And so in what follows, what we want to do is we want to cover this in two big points: Maybe this is the law of diminishing returns. Pat had 7, Dr. Van Drunen had 5, I've got 2. All right? But that doesn't mean we're getting out of here any earlier, okay? Just for the record, all right? And the 2 big points are this. The first point is this, is we want to look about at the doctrine of God for a brief little while, because it's so important that we situate the law of God and relate it to our doctrine of God, in the sense that if we don't have a proper assessment and understanding and appreciation and love for who God is, well, then it's very natural that we will not have a proper esteem for His law. In other words, how many of you have ever been sifting through the mail and you get a piece of mail and instantaneously you know that it's not worth your while, you tear it in half and throw it in the trash? But if there's a piece of mail that you get and all of a sudden you realize, hey, I know this person, this is a worthwhile piece of mail, I need to keep this, it's special. If we have a better understanding of who the lawgiver is, then we will have a proper appreciation of the law that He has given us. So the first thing that we'll do is we'll look at the doctrine of God, even if it's somewhat brief for a moment. And then secondly, we'll look at the 3 uses of the law. Dr. Van Drunen alluded to those in his lecture, the first, the second, and the third uses. So the doctrine of God, situating the law of God in relationship to who God is, and then secondly, the 3 uses of the law. So let's first situate the law in our doctrine of God. As I said before, I think so many Christians believe that when it comes to the law of God, it's just a set of arbitrary rules that He imposed upon us, rules to make us miserable. And I think that this is, of course, an attitude that is fueled by a human sinful nature. Sinners that we are, especially if we consider ourselves sinners outside of Christ for a moment. It was Stephen Charnock, the 17th century Presbyterian pastor, who said that for someone who is deeply in love with sin, then the thing that he desires most is to abolish the law, because it is ultimately that which stands in his way of pursuing that which he loves so much. But if you want to change the law, then ultimately what that means is that you want to change the lawgiver, because the law is a reflection of the lawgiver. And if you want to change the lawgiver, then what you're proposing, especially if we're talking about the law of God, is making a change to the immutable nature of God Himself. And what is it but to desire God's destruction if you want to change His immutable, holy nature? And this is ultimately, I think, what this boils down to. It goes back to what happened in the Garden of Eden so long ago, when Satan slithered up on Eve and said, you know, did he really say this? And you know that if you eat of this, you'll be like him. There's a sense in which that's where our proper estimation of the law must rest. Will we approach the law according to our own understanding, or will we approach it according to how God has laid it out? Will we follow it, or will we try to destroy it? And so what we want to do is we want to think to what a number of key theologians have said about the relationship between God and His law. You know, it brings to mind an idea that I remember one time I was going to show my kids a movie from my childhood, and they're like, "Dad, is this movie from the 1900s?" And then the next question got even better. It's like, "Dad, is this movie gray?" It's like, "Yes, it's from the 1900s. No, it is not black and white. I want you to go play in traffic." It's like, I can't believe how poorly you are treating my childhood. It's like, no. So it may seem like, hey, we're going to go back into the Middle Ages. Well, the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. We're going to go back not to the 1900s, we're going to go back to the 400s, but it's because if we take seriously what the Apostle Paul said in Ephesians chapter 4, that when Christ ascended into the heavens and he poured out the Spirit upon the church, that he gave gifts to the church, and among those gifts that he has given, it's pastors and teachers. But it's not just pastors and teachers that are around living and breathing, moving around and talking, but rather it is pastors and teachers throughout the entire history of the church. And so that's why we want to go back first to the 400s, all the way back there to St. Augustine. St. Augustine, who lived in the 4th and 5th centuries, he said that when humans disregard God, who presides over all people, they desire to play God. I think that's so true. And what he says about this is that he says, loving its own power over itself or others rather than God's power over all. That's what lies at the heart of idolatry. Loving oneself more than God. And so what's the remedy to this? Among many things that he says what the law of God helps us to do is it helps us to understand who God is. He says the eternal law is the sovereign type to which we must always conform. You know, think of it in the simplest of biblical terms. If we're made in the image of God, then that means that ideally our goal for our entire existence should be conformity to the mold that made us. And the path, if you will, or at least the guide to that conformity lies in the law, which Augustine says is a reflection of who God is. It's a reflection of who he is. Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages, in the 12th century, talks about this idea along the lines of discussing a painting and its artist. You know, I suspect that there are all of us that have various interests and hobbies. You know, I can't say that I'm a very good appreciationist of art, but I can tell an impressionist artist when I see it. I know a little bit about art, enough to say that's an impressionist painting. You know, early on in my wife's, in my marriage, we got to buying really quality, well-made furniture. You know, not the sawdust stuff that's glued together from IKEA. Maybe I shouldn't mention that. Pactum sponsor. We'll say not that sawdust stuff that's glued together by the Swedish Walmart, but stuff that's made by a craftsman, and it's ruined me. Because I can look at a piece of furniture and I can say, that's a good piece of furniture. But in the piece of furniture, I can tell how the craftsman has left his imprint, if you will, upon the piece of work. You know, whether it's motorcycles, whether it's art, whether it's books, you can tell something of the author from the way that the thing is made or that it's designed. And this is the way that Aquinas describes it. He says, accordingly, the eternal law is nothing else than the type of divine wisdom as directing all actions and movements. He says, as we look at the law, this is in very similar terms as to Augustine. He says, it is the eternal law that is there within God himself, and everything must conform to it. Or as we look to the eternal law, we must look to it so that it directs all of our actions and movements. Now, this is not something that is necessarily all that unique to an Augustine or to an Aquinas, but in the 16th century, it was John Calvin, the 16th century Genevan reformer, who argued very similarly. He puts this in his Genevan Catechism. Now, mind you, this catechism was not only for initiates, in other words, those who were new to the Christian faith, but it was also supposed to be for the instruction of children and for young people. Okay? So it's not necessarily highbrow stuff, but rather it's very practically minded stuff. And what he says in the 25th question of his Genevan Catechism, he says, why do you add that he, God, is creator of heaven and earth? He says, because he has manifested himself to us by his works. One of the passages that they cite here is Romans 1:20, which Dr. Van Drunen quoted earlier this evening. We ought to seek him in them, in his works. Our mind cannot comprehend his essence, but the world is for us like a mirror in which we may contemplate him insofar as it is expedient for us to know him. So he says the world is a mirror, and a part of the created world, as Dr. Van Drunen talked about in the last lecture, is the natural law, and we can say, therefore, the law that God has created for the world, not only in the world, but in us, and it is a mirror in which we can contemplate God. So far from a set of arbitrary rules, here, what can I do to make people, you know, miserable? It's a reflection. The law is a reflection upon God. And if you pay careful, close attention to the way that Paul, for example, describes the law, and then listen to the language that the scriptures use to describe God, you will find the same terms, the same adjectives used for both. The Apostle Paul says this in Romans 7:12, so the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. These are the same terms that the Bible applies to God himself. That should tell us something. Psalm 7:11, God is a righteous judge. Psalm 71:22, he's called the Holy One of Israel? Or what does the book of Acts say of Jesus? Acts 3:14, the Holy and Righteous One? Jesus is the Holy and Righteous One. Yahweh, God, is the Holy One of Israel. He is a righteous judge. What is the law? Holy, righteous, and good. The fact that we have the same terms applied both to the law and to the triune God tells us that the law is a reflection. It's a mirror of the triune God. If you want to know what God is like, you look at his law. That will tell you what he's like. But then conversely, if we have been made in the image of God, then not only does the law of God tell us what God is like, but then it also should tell us what we're supposed to be like. So this, I think, is the first, biggest, and most important step that we can take, is recognizing who the lawgiver is, the holiness of the God that we serve, and also acknowledging and understanding that the law is a reflection of God's character, and it's a reflection of his being. So if we make this connection, I think hopefully that's going to inform us as we look at our second key point this evening, and that is to look at the three uses of the law. Now, it was Martin Luther who was one of the first to formally distinguish these three uses of the law. I think you can find them spread out throughout church history, but he's the first one to kind of gather them together and to put them in this threefold explanation, in that he wrote his small catechism, which was a manual intended for the heads of household that, as fathers, for example, would teach their households and their children, they would teach them the law of God, and in so doing, it would teach the household to fear and love God, and it was also followed with some specific ethical instruction. You know, so here's Luther, one of the chief promoters of the gospel in the 16th century, and yet he thinks it's important enough to write a catechism to have for households so that fathers can instruct their families in the law of God. That should give us a clue as to the importance and the abiding nature and necessity of the law of God. but it also hinges upon a proper use of it, okay? And so the subsequent Lutheran tradition has summarized the substance of Luther's instruction in the following way. First, it says this, God uses the law to limit or prevent outbursts of sin, thereby helping to keep order in the world. So there's a curbing function to the law. That's the first use. It curbs immoral behavior. Second, it says here, he uses the law to reveal and to condemn our sin as a mirror. We can say that this is the second use of the law, which is the pedagogical use. We'll get to that in a minute. Or the mirror use of the law. How many of us, I suspect most of us, maybe those of us who are truly sanctified don't ever look in mirrors. I'm not one of them. You know, it's like, you know, I was at my daughter's school the other day. It was her birthday, and so my wife and I went to meet her for lunch. And one of her friends, as we were leaving, said, "Who's this?" I said, he says, "Is this your dad?" And I was, and I said, "Yep, that's me. I'm her dad." And the friend said, "Why is he so old and wrinkly?" So I look in the mirror and I'm like, what is that? Is that a wrinkle on my earlobe? How did that get there? All right, well, there's a mirror function and the pedagogical function. We'll look at that shortly. And then third, he says this, God uses the law to guide and direct our thoughts, words, and deeds as Christians in God-pleasing ways. So the law curbs the world's sin. It serves as a mirror so that we can see our sin, and it's a guide for the Christian life. Let's dive deeper into each one of these. In terms of curbing sin, this is what theologians will call the civil or the political use of the law. Okay? It serves the commonwealth or the body politic as a tool for restraining sin. And this is where the knowledge of the law of God, as Dr. Van Drunen says, comes through natural revelation. You know, we all know that it's wrong to steal. We may not want to acknowledge it. And even thieves will say, "Well, isn't it okay to steal?" Yeah, it's okay to steal so long as you don't steal from me, right? So we all know this. We all know this. God has written his law, as Dr. Van Drunen said in the last lecture, on our hearts, according to Romans 2:14 and 15, okay? And so in this sense, We governments use the law, societies use the law, various, you know, every culture uses the law, and that we all have laws, and there's a lot of similarity in how these laws appeal in various nations and in cultures. You know, C.S. Lewis once said, yes, there are laws against adultery. Maybe some cultures you have more than one spouse. But even then, in those cultures, they recognize it's not okay to violate the bonds of that marriage. We all know this. All of us know intuitively, not only intuitively, but because of the speed limit signs posted, don't speed. And, you know, think about it. What if there were no laws in a country and in a nation? We know that chaos would ensue. Paul says this in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 8 and following. Now, we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully, understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who strike their fathers and mothers, for murderers, the sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality, enslavers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. So there's the curbing function or the political function of the law that all people know through government. But secondly, there is the mirror function or the pedagogical function of the law. Now, yes, Luther talks about it in this way, but so does John Calvin. He says the law is a kind of a mirror, As in a mirror we discover any stains upon our face, so in the law we behold first our impotence, then in consequence of it, our sin, and finally the curse as the consequence of both. In other words, just like me, looking in the mirror, thinking, oh no, there's another wrinkle, right? There's another line. Where did that one come from? This is what happens when we look into the law as a perfect reflection of God's character, as we see His holiness revealed therein, and then we compare ourselves to what we see in the law, and we recognize by the conviction of the Holy Spirit that we don't measure up. It's in this way that the Apostle Paul has likened the function of the law in 2 Corinthians 3:7 as a ministry of death. You know, think about it this way. It's like one of the things that's on my bucket list, don't know if I'll ever get to do it, is I want to go to base camp at Everest. And notice I said base camp. Okay? I'm no fool. In some, you know, dreams and things, I think, yeah, wouldn't that be cool to be up the top of Everest? But I also know that lots of people die doing that, so no. I just want to stand at base camp, and I want to look up. And I want to look up and see if I can see the top. There's a sense in which that's the way it is to look at the law of God when we are sinful people and that we are outside of Christ. Except this analogy breaks down because we know that hundreds of people have summited Everest over the years. Not so with the law of God if we're seeking to try to provide enough obedience to the law that we are no longer guilty of it. You know, we have to remember this about the law in this sense is that, as Pat said in his lecture, he uses this alliteration that comes from the Westminster Larger Catechism. When it comes to the law, we have to perpetually obey it, perfectly obey it, and personally obey it. The slightest infraction means that it's all for naught. In nearly 40 plus years of driving a car, ever since moving to the state of Mississippi, I've never had to replace so many windshields in my life. I don't know what it is. I think in part it's because they don't require load tarping, so you don't have to tarp your loads. And so there's oftentimes rocks being kicked up all over, and I'll be driving down the road, and you're like, oh, come on. I am wound tight about a lot of things in life. Just ask my wife. And I get a crack in the windshield, and I'm like, oh, I don't think it's okay. It's still perfect. I think there's a crack. It's this big, the big as a pinhole, but it's in my line of sight. The windshield is ruined. And I even tell my wife, I want a new windshield. And she's like, why don't you wait till the third or fourth crack? The burden I bear. But how many of us would have a mirror at home if you took and one of your kids, this is hypothetical, don't try this at home, took the BB gun and shot and hit it, and you would just say, no, it's just a small little crack in the mirror. It's just a small, you'd be like, no, it's ruined. That's the way of God's law. It's perfect or nothing. Why? Is it because God is overbearing? No. It's because there is no shadow of turning in Him. It's a reflection of Him. And that's why you have to be absolutely perfect so that you reflect Him perfectly. And if you don't reflect Him, then you fall short. That's what it means to fall short of the glory of God. It means you fall short of His glorious, holy perfection. And it's in this way that the Apostle Paul, quoting Galatians 3:24 in the King James, says, wherefore the law was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ that we might be justified by faith. In other words, it's the schoolmaster. My dad used to tell this story that he was in school And he said he had to play a piano, but that the piano had no chords in it. It was a silent piano. And it was to teach the piano player, in theory, that, you know, to hit the right notes apart from the sound. But that standing over him, it was a Catholic school, was a nun with a ruler. And if any of you have been to parochial school, you know what's happening is that he says that he'd miss a note on the silent piano and he'd get a rap over the knuckles with a ruler. That was the schoolmaster. That's what the law in its pedagogical or mirror function says, is it says you failed. You missed the mark. You're looking at a mountain higher than Everest. You can't reach the peak. You can't summit. What Calvin says on this, quoting Augustine, notice how far back this goes, the law was given in order to convert a great into a little man. Apart from the law, we think we do great. We think we're doing just wonderful. You know, it goes back to when I was a single man. I thought, yeah, I think I'm pretty giving. And then I got married. And then we started having thermostat wars. That was within the first, you know, month or so. It's like, what is this thing broken? Who keeps on? What is wrong with this? And then I finally realized it was my wife who was constantly raising the thermostat because she was too cold. And I was like, no, I'm sweating over here. We need to drop it. And I would get bugged about it. Well, praise God in his mercy, we ironed that out. Got it solved. And I thought once again, all right, I think I'm pretty giving. I'm sacrificial. And then Junior arrived. And Junior is not one to be negotiated with because Junior cries, doesn't speak English. It's just making demands. And all of a sudden, I realize yet again, I'm not as giving as I thought I was. I'm not as sacrificial as I thought I was. I'm not as holy as I thought I was because I'm thinking all kinds of things I probably shouldn't be thinking as this child is screaming at me. We've all been there. Maybe not with an infant, but in those similar circumstances. Well, that's what the law does in its pedagogical function. It says you aren't good enough, and it brings you to the end of your rope so that you then cry out and say, oh, Lord, I can't do it. And God says, exactly. You can't. How else can we appreciate the good news unless we recognize how bad the bad news really is? 19th century Presbyterian by the name of Ralph Erskine put it this way, you prize not heaven till he through hell you draw, nor love the gospel till you know the law. You have to look into the face of the law and see God's just condemnation against you and recognize you can't do it. And then recognize, as John Newton once wrote in his hymn, let us love and sing and wonder. Let us praise the Savior's name. He has hushed the law's loud thunder. He has quenched Mount Sinai's flame. He has washed us with his blood. He has drawn us nigh to God. And that's what the second use of the law teaches us. It's Christ who has done it. It is Christ who has given us this gospel grace. And then third and finally, here under this second point, is the third use of the law, which is it's a guide for the Christian life, or what some theologians call the normative use of the law. In other words, this is what shows us the conduct that is befitting one who is saved. So often it's the case, I think, that people will think of the law. If we're trying to understand the nature of obedience, we think we want to immediately turn it into a ladder. Oh, you're using this as a ladder to climb to heaven. You're trying to get into heaven through your obedience. And the third use of the law would say no, because Christ has already secured your salvation. In other words, listen carefully to this sentence, because it turns on a dime. You do not obey in order to be saved. but rather you obey because you are saved. There's a world of difference in that. Quite literally, the difference between heaven and hell. And so instead of thinking of the ladder imagery and that the law serving as a ladder, instead I want you to think of this: salvation through your union with Christ, being united to Christ by faith in Christ through the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. Union with Christ is the road of salvation. And the law, in its normative or its guide function, are like the guardrails on the side of the road, so that it lets you know when you've left the road and when you've departed off into the weeds. It lets you know, hey, you've departed the road by God's grace in Christ through faith alone, by His grace alone. You need to get back on that road. And the law points to you and shows you this is where the road lies. It's in this way, for example, that the psalmist speaks of the law in Psalm 19, verses 7 and 8. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening your eyes. This is where the psalmist can say, and this imagery is so vivid for me, because I live so much of my life in the dark. And by that, I mean I get up at the crack of dawn because I got to get stuff done. I got to start work. I got to get my workout in and everything. But it's that time of the morning that if you turned on a light, it would sound like a bell. Bong! And everybody in the house wakes up. Hey, what's going on? So I go around with my cell phone flashlight, and it's necessary because some of you know what I'm about to say. You step on a Lego barefoot? Oh, my word, that's horrible. That's like, oh, you talk about needing the third use of the law right there in that moment. You know, it's like, oh, boy. But it's vivid imagery for me because as I get my flashlight out, my cell phone light, I walk, it lets me see so that I don't trip over things, so that I don't fall, so that I don't step on that Lego minefield, and so that I can make it up to my office and back and then eventually out of the house. Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. And so here, this is where we have to recognize that this is where we still need the law of God to guide us through life. Of course, it's not divorced from wisdom. The law doesn't address every single circumstance in life, but rather think of the law and wisdom as the compass that guides us and points us in the right direction. In the words, again, of Erskine, he says, "When I, the gospel truth, believe, obedience to the law I give. And when I don't the law observe, I from the gospel method swerve. Yet if I do the law obey, I am not in the gospel way, which does to new obedience draw, yet is the gospel no new law." In other words, it's not God saying to us, as Pat said earlier, combining law and gospel, "All right, I've saved you, now it's your chance to try again." No, Christ has secured our salvation, and by defanging and declawing the law, taking the curse out of the law because He's borne it for us, He gives us the law to say, here's a guide to show you what godly living looks like. This is a guide to show you what you should look like in word, thought, and deed. So as we reflect upon the law of God in its first and second and third uses, to curb sin as a mirror to where we can see our sinfulness, and then as a guide for the Christian life, we should circle back to go back to our doctrine of God. Remember what we said about the law, what we said about the law being a reflection of God's perfect, righteous, and holy being, and that if it is a reflection of God's law, then we who are image bearers are also supposed to reflect God's holiness, His righteousness, and His moral integrity. We're supposed to be reflections of God. And that in God's hands, what he uses the law to do is he uses the law to prepare us to meet him, to look upon him face to face. Psalm 27, verse 11, David says, "Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path." Why does he say that? Again, Psalm 27, verse 4, "One thing I have asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." How is it that he's going to dwell in the temple of God? How is it that he's going to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord for all eternity? Because he says, "Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path." That is what God does for us in the third use of the law. That is what God does for us in the second use of the law, as he shows us our sin and shows us our desperate need for Christ. It's the tool that he uses to bring us to himself. In the light of all the truth of God's law and all that it is, we should pray that God would write these truths upon the walls of our hearts, so that with the psalmist we would be able to say, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day." Thank you.